Marshall, please call the next case. Good morning, counsel. Just a brief reminder that we do record these arguments. There will be an audio recording available within about 24 hours on the branch website. So when you begin your argument, please be sure to introduce yourself and let us know how to pronounce your name and introduce your client. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes to start and also 5 minutes for rebuttal. So if you can both see the clock up here, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Lebo. I represent Mike Allen Homes, LLC, which is the appellant cross-respondent, and I'll just refer to it as appellant. May it please the court, counsel. When a party presents insufficient evidence on an element of its claim, including damages, ordinarily it should lose that claim. That is a pretty fundamental proposition of law. And in a jury trial, the jury is typically instructed that a party asking for damages must prove the nature, extent, duration, and consequences of his or her injury or harm. It must not decide damages based on speculation or guess. That's from CIVJIG 90.15. What shouldn't happen, and what we're asking the court to decide cannot happen, is that the district court steps in and gives a party a second bite at the apple when it has failed to prove an element. That's a procedure that is antithetical to the rules of civil procedure. It contravenes Supreme Court case law. It allows district courts an impermissible, arbitrary exercise of power, and it upsets the orderly progression of cases through the legal system. Respondent's theory in opposition to this is that this is a clarification of testimony that was already in the record. And we don't accept that framing at all. But even if one does, when a party tries and then briefs a case without giving the finder of fact the ability to understand its evidence on the damages that it claims, that party should lose on those damages. That would be the result in a jury trial, and there's no reason that it should be any different in a bench trial. Mm-hmm. We think it's unlikely that something like this would ever be permissible, but even if there were some circumstances in which it were, these aren't those circumstances. The district court provided no explanation as to why this result was called for, other than respondents did not prove their case on some elements of damages or some items of damages. And we believe that the record doesn't even suggest that there is any other explanation. I would be happy to take the court's questions on that piece of the appeal, but otherwise I will move on to the slander of title issue.
Can you address respondent's argument that the district court had the authority to order further proceedings, as it called it in its order, under Rule 611 and Rule 614?
Yeah, Your Honor. The problem is that this was not some, intermediate step. This was a full new trial. And that's been held by the Ginsburg case primarily not to be acceptable. This was not, we're taking a break. I'm looking back at this testimony. I'm seeing an issue that I, wasn't seeing, and I'm going to take on a role that frankly is even, typically used sparingly, even though the rules do allow for it. But here we had the end of the trial. Everyone rested. The district court gave the parties time to order the transcripts, which they did. There was briefing that was intended to be final briefing. Nothing was intended to be reserved. And the district court issued findings of fact and conclusions of law. And in fact, a judgment, though it later vacated that judgment. So, and as we pointed out in our brief, we think it's particularly concerning that the district court would say, here are the items of damages that I'm allowing, that I'm finding, and here are some that we know are there, but you haven't proven them adequately for me to issue them in a judgment. So we're going back and we're going to retry that.
But isn't there a distinction between saying we're going to allow you to bring in additional proof and have a second trial versus this information was presented and already contained in the expert reports, and we're just going to clarify what that information shows?
Well, I don't think those are separable in any clean way from an evidentiary perspective. The court needed more testimony. Now, if the court had needed more briefing, there's perhaps a conceptual difference there. But that wasn't the case. The court said, I essentially can't make sense of this, and I need more evidence in the form perhaps of testimony to understand it. And again, you know, that's the kind of distinction that just isn't acceptable without a new trial.
What if Mr. Buss had finished his testimony in the initial trial and stepped down, no parties had any other questions, and then the court, as he's walking out of the courtroom, says, actually, I have another question I want to ask you, and calls him back to the stand, because this was a bench trial. And he gets back on the stand and the court asks the exact kinds of questions that happen in this second trial, because the second trial you characterize as a full new trial, but it was Mr. Buss. That was one witness and one new exhibit, right?
Right. I mean, the court.
So would that scenario have been improper in your view if that had happened during the same time frame?
No, I don't think so. I think that does fall within the rules of evidence that respondents cite.
Even if, you know, both parties said we rest our case, he happened to be the last witness. I don't remember if he was, but. And says, oh, Mr. Buss, come back.
Yeah.
So at that point, you wouldn't say that that's a new trial, that's a violation of the rules of civil procedure.
Correct. I think that during trial, the court has a great deal of latitude in how it's going to take evidence, you know, whether testimony or documentary. And of course, especially in a bench trial where it's the finder of fact. But it's that break in the trial, everyone's done, everyone's rested, the trial is over. I mean, the court was on the 90-day clock to issue its decision. And so at that point, in our view, it loses the discretion to say, I want more evidence on these issues. The parties have rested, the record is closed. And that's another thing is sometimes there's a procedure for, you know, keeping open the record. And the court sees that all the time in, for example, child support cases. But here there was nothing like that. Everyone was under the impression that the trial was done. And then it was suddenly reopened because respondents had failed to prove this piece of their claim.
Why wouldn't this be harmless error? I mean, your client had a full opportunity in the second proceeding or second trial to test the evidence. What was the prejudice here? Were there some sort of strategic decisions made at the time that the parties rested in the first proceeding that perhaps suggests prejudice to your client in the second proceeding?
Well, I think the prejudice is in, you know, is in the mere fact of having to try the case a second time when there was no good reason for that. New trials, you know, and I look to Ginsburg. In Ginsburg, the district court issued ordered a new trial in the interests of justice, and the Supreme Court said no, that's not an acceptable procedure. And so I don't think there's a harmless error analysis here in the idea that the judgment was delayed for a long time. There was a huge amount of additional expense, and so I don't think this kind of process is really subject to harmless error analysis. Well, the judgment really is the judgment. And again, judgment was entered. It was vacated, but it was entered.
Your client didn't object, though, until the start of the second proceeding, right? I mean, and your client knew, because at the end of the order, the January 2022 order, the district court said that the damages are going to come before the court for further proceedings, and then ordered the parties to mediate. So why why isn't there some sort of issue there with, you know, client didn't ask, demand that judgment be entered immediately and enter an objection then?
Well, and I want to mention, of course, that respondents didn't raise this, but to the extent that the court would want to raise it itself, there isn't really a great opportunity to object, in part because this is such a unusual procedure. You know, you can't file for a new trial. You can't file for amended findings because the findings aren't final yet. And there's this second phase of this, you know, this new trial. So it's a difficult, I think it's very difficult to put appellant in the position where it needs to object beyond what it did. And it did, as Your Honor points out, you know, when there's not really a process built for that, because there isn't a process built for what the district court did. So I'll turn fairly briefly here, of course, to the slander of title issue. We believe that respondents have failed to show that they could have prevailed on any element, and thus they come nowhere close to showing that the district court clearly erred on any element, and I speak to contested elements. So in the first place, it's very doubtful that there was any false statement made. There is perhaps a plausible argument that the spelling errors in the pre-lien notice invalidated the notice and thus the lien. But there's no case holding or obviously compelling that result. And there could be some very tricky lines to be drawn. You know, if there was an ink smudge that made it appear as if a word was misspelled, would that invalidate a pre-lien notice? I don't know, but that's exactly the problem. But, you know, there's the idea that there's a plausible argument that the lien wouldn't be valid isn't the way that slander of title or anything else works. Malice is required. And the supposed malice that respondents assert isn't enough. It couldn't be enough to get them to a preponderance of the evidence in the first instance. And so it's nowhere close to being near the clear error showing that they need to make to obtain reversal here. Everything that respondents cite for the malice element is either irrelevant to that element or almost entirely, if not entirely, speculative. A lot of what respondents ask the court not just to ding appellant for, but to find clear error in, is just the background facts. Mr. Allen is experienced. The error was made. The lien was in an amount that was not ultimately borne out by the court. But none of that could show malice, and it certainly isn't clear error. And there's just a lot of conflation between the malice element, which in many of these cases is the key element here, and the other elements. And that's always a danger with this kind of claim. Again, I don't have any argument on the prejudgment interest, so I'd be happy to take the court's questions on.
You don't have any argument on the prejudgment interest
issue? I
think
we briefed that as well as we're going to argue it here. I'm happy to take the court's questions on either of those elements.
Can I ask a question about the pre-lien notice issue? Because your counterpart cites Nywind or Nywind, and in Nywind, I understand your argument on the other elements, but in Nywind, the issue was not printing in the capital letters, and the court held that that technical violation was enough to invalidate the lien, and you know, that was based on the statute 514.011, and 514.011 specifically sets out the exact language that has to go in the pre-lien notice. Is the reason you're conceding that it possibly might be invalid based on the misspellings, that the misspellings went to precisely the quoted language that's in the statute, and that would be a technical violation because the language wasn't used that is specified by the legislature that needs to go into a pre-lien notice?
Yes, Your Honor. I want to make clear that we're not conceding that it, in fact, was a false statement by any means. We're conceding that there's a plausible argument that it was based on that. And the problem is, you know, so how far does strict compliance go in this kind of case? Does that mean?
Well, yeah, I would have thought we would have answered that in Nguyen. I mean, that seemed pretty technical to me. It was an 11-point font in that case. It's not like anyone couldn't read it, but this court still held that because it wasn't capital letters that was invalid.
Right. But, you know, we could get into some truly agonizing hair splitting here about, you know, again, I use the example of, is a smudge enough? Does a smudge that makes, you know, I don't know, a D look like an A enough to invalidate the entire notice? Maybe. Again, we're not saying that that's out of the question, but, you know, that element also ties into the idea of malice, where malice requires, and if I may just finish my answer, a knowing false statement. And so, you know, there's no case directly on point, or, you know, again, Nguyen is suggestive of what that result might be.
Counsel, would you agree that the concern in Nguyen with the fact that the font was not in bold and not in capital letters more to do with the visibility and ensuring that individuals read the pre-lien notice and are aware of it, as opposed to a misspelling, which might not actually go to that concern?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, I don't remember if there was any testimony about confusion, actual confusion by anyone. I know there was testimony by appellant about, you know, the whether it made sense or not. But, you know, again, there's a plausible outcome here. But as with, again, defamation, slander of other kinds, the mere existence of a question generally isn't enough to get you to the element of falseness or malice.
Thank you, counsel. So we will turn next to counsel for respondent. We'll add 15 minutes to the clock and give you a moment to get settled. And you may begin when you're ready. Please recall, we'd like you to introduce your name and the name of your client at the beginning.
You need a bigger podium. Good morning. My name is Jim McGeaney. I represent the respondent and cross appellants, Matthew and Shannon Hiley. May it please the court and counsel. I think I'd like to start quickly with the slander of title claim, because that's where you ended up. I think our brief points out clearly the issue with the slander of title. I agree with Judge Ady that it's a technical violation to misspell words, but that's enough to invalidate the notice. And this court has said that over and over again. And there was testimony by appellant that, in fact, the violations, the misspellings, made the notice confusing and nonsensical. And I think that's more of an issue than just a font. I think that's a clearer violation than just the wrong font or the wrong capitals. As the court said, a homeowner can read the capitals, a notice all caps, and still understand the meaning of the notice. But when you have words that are misspelled that make the notice confusing or nonsensical, that's a worse violation, I guess, which invalidates the notice.
But even if we agree with you, you still had to prove malice.
We do. And I think the evidence is clear that there's circumstantial evidence of malice. There's the fact that Mike Allen was a 27-year experienced general contractor. He knew about the Hileys situation. He knew that the Hileys had to get a construction loan. He's a savvy builder. He knew that filing the lien would prevent them from refinancing that loan. He knew that that would put them in a tough position, arguably to force the issue and get them to pay the demand that he made for $18,000 that was, and that the trial court found was way overstated. Another element of the malice is he overstated the lien by, I don't know, 80%. So
let's
Let's just stick with, instead of talking about intentionally overstated for the moment, in terms of the malice, I mean, contractors file liens all the time. because it's part of their practice in their business to ensure that they get paid. So how does the fact that this individual filed this lien show malice beyond, I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble since it's pretty standard for folks to file liens, finding the malice here.
He never tried to enforce the lien. We think that's evidence of malice. So he filed the lien. What's the purpose of filing the lien? To foreclose on the lien, to ensure payment. He never took any action on the lien other than to file it. And the result, so the only result of filing the lien was to put the Hileys in a situation that they were having difficulty restructuring their construction loan, refinancing their loan. And he knew that. He testified. He knew that that would be the consequence of filing the lien. That's where the malice is.
Did he testify that that was why he did it, though? I think, are we being asked here to speculate about his reasons?
I think what you're being asked is, and what we asked the district court to do, is draw a reasonable inference. The evidence, the circumstantial evidence, leads to the conclusion that he filed that lien. Like you said, lots of contractors file liens, but the purpose of the lien is to help collect, not to help push the homeowner into a situation. He never took action on the lien other than filing it. Why file it if you're not going to try to foreclose on it and go that route to ensure payment? So the reasonable inference is that he filed the lien to put pressure on the Hileys to pay his bill, which clearly the Hileys weren't willing to do. I want to touch on the new trial theory that the state has. I think that appellant has. I do a lot of criminal defense work. So appellant argues that there was a second trial. There wasn't. It wasn't a second trial. None of the things that would happen at a trial happened before that second proceeding. There was no scheduling order. There was no pretrial hearing. There were no opening statements. There was no additional discovery. It was further proceedings, as the court pointed out. And I'm going to concede, this was an unusual case. There were unusual things that happened in the district court in this case that were out of the party's control. And it's not usual for a district court to conduct further proceedings. Rather than ask the witness as he's walking out the door, wait a minute, I have a few questions, to reconvene the parties to ask those questions. But that's really what happened here. To say that the defendants didn't prove their damages is a misstatement. The district court made a finding that the defendants were the appellant was in breach and the defendants were substantially harmed. The evidence of the damages was in the record. It's Exhibit 99. It was there. I would argue the district court did not need to conduct further proceedings to award the damages that were in Exhibit 99. And what the district court did, and it's in her findings, the first set of findings, where she said she wanted some additional explanation.
But didn't the judge also say that the evidence in the record is insufficient and does not allow the court to make a determination as to work to be completed and the appropriate costs for the same? So the district court found damages as to the well and some electrical work, but for everything else, the district court found that the evidence was insufficient. And later the district court says the evidence presented from defendants relative to these damages is insufficient. So the district court's saying that defendants did not meet their burden of proof on damages.
I don't think that's what she means. That's what she's saying. In fact, in the first statement, work completed, I believe the district court in that statement was referencing the plaintiff's claims, not the defendant's claims, because the plaintiff's claim all along was we're owed money for the work we completed on this property. I think that's a reference to the plaintiff's claim.
Where do you get that? Because paragraph 20, which I was quoting from, is all about defendants, whether they're entitled to an award of damages. So how does it, what language can you point me to suggest that the court was really referring to plaintiffs and not the plaintiff and not defendants?
The only person who was claiming that work had been completed was the plaintiff. The defendant's claims were that the work had not been done or had been done defectively. The plaintiff's claim, and I appreciate the order's a little bit confusing on that issue, but the district court in its orders talked about the opportunity for the plaintiff to prove why they were entitled to some monies as well. And I can't imagine any other reason in the district court would be the, using the words work completed unless it was referencing the plaintiff's claims, because the defendants were not suing for completed work. Their claims were for incomplete or defective work. And the last sentence of paragraph 20 in the order is also confusing. I think that the word defendant is transposed with plaintiff, because why would they be asking for work that was never paid for in the first place? That the plaintiff is asking for work that was paid for, not the defendants. So I think the district court just was confused in its order. I don't think the district court's referencing the evidence on the defendant's claims, because the evidence is in the record. Exhibit 99 is the evidence.
But the language is pretty specific in paragraph 20. I mean, the court states the court received an exhibit detailing Mr. Buss's estimated costs of repair. And then it goes on to say the court must determine the specific repair that must be made and the corresponding cost for the same. This cannot be done based on the limited evidence in the record. I mean, that doesn't indicate confusion to me. That's direct speaking about exhibit 99. And so, I mean, I think the problem for me is that you have both parties resting and the court taking this under advisement. And it seems to me like your argument is going to require us to completely ignore Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 59. And why isn't that the case?
Because the court was clear in its order, its first order, that it was going to take more evidence, that procedure was not complete. And the district court has the authority to control the...
But the district court issued findings of facts, conclusions of law. I mean, it didn't appear to just be leaving the record open to take more evidence. It called it a second trial.
Well, I think the district court called it further proceedings as well. I think that calling it something doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it is. And I think that's what the plaintiff continues to call it, a second trial. But in the original findings, the district court was clear. At the end of its findings, said this matter's not done. So it did issue conclusions of law.
But why isn't that the Ginsburg type situation where what we have is the court's dissatisfied with the result and the district court judge is dissatisfied with the result and decides to order a new trial for the proceedings, however you want to call it. But that's not something that's contemplated in the rules of civil procedure. And if we disregard that here, I think your counterpart is arguing that what's to stop district courts from disregarding it in every case.
Well, again, I respectfully don't think it's a new trial. I think the district court in its final paragraph, this matter shall come before the court for further proceedings. So the district court was clear in its first order that it was not done.
Is it accurate to say that both parties had rested?
Yes.
Okay. Then how is it not a new trial where there's the court didn't ask the questions? It was the next phase was presented like a trial.
Well, it wasn't presented like a trial. Again, there was no pretrial conference. There were no opening statements. There was the recall of a witness as the court kind of gave the analogy to Mr. Buss leaving the courtroom. And I think appellants conceded that wouldn't be error, right? It's really not different than Mr. Buss walking out the door and being asked to come back on the stand. We were on Zoom. The district court completed the process.
So what is your best argument that this process didn't give your client or clients a second bite at the apple?
Because the damages had already been proven in Exhibit 99. And all the district court was asking for was to help it understand how these line-by-line items attach to Mr. Buss's testimony. Remember, Exhibit 99 went in without objection. The appellants didn't object to the cost of repairs. In the last page of the trial transcript, Mr. Buss is asked, is this the amount of money it would cost to fix the work? And he said, yes. The case is proven that the damages were proven by Exhibit 99, by Buss's testimony at the trial in the first proceeding, I'll call it, and that exhibit was unobjected to. All the trial court was asking for was to help it understand, help explain how this works. You know, the trial court. Maybe it's the trial court's first trial using the Xactimate software to show cost of repairs that contractors use. But the evidence was already in. The second proceeding, the only exhibit, the second proceeding, the difference in the exhibits was just the amounts adjusted for inflation between 2019 and 2022.
Would you agree that the perhaps the total amount of damages that Bust spoke of and his exhibit spoke to that were admitted spoke to the total amount, but perhaps didn't prove specific amounts as to specific items that needed to be corrected or specific work that needed to be done?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think they proved both those things. I think the total amount was proven in Exhibit 99, and the individual line items were proven by a
So if they had proven the specific pieces, why would the court have needed any additional proceedings?
I don't think it did, but she wasn't satisfied. The district court wanted to understand how it worked. I think the second proceeding was only for the district court's ability to better understand how these line items were done, what the exact work was. Because Bus, the exhibit went in with, I don't know, 70 line items of work that needed to be proceeded. The only difference, the only thing that happened in the second proceeding was that Bus went through the line items one by one and said, yep, the doors were warped. They needed to be replaced. This is how much it cost. Yep, the ceiling was warped. It needed to be redone. This is how much it cost. Yep, the bathtub was cracked. This is how much it...
But he needed to do that because that wasn't done in the first trial, correct?
Correct. But I don't think he needed to do that in the first trial. The district court didn't need to have Bus. In other words, Bus said, this is the exhibit. This is the last two pages of the trial transcript, I believe. This is the exhibit. And he was asked, is this how much it would cost to repair the defective work? And there was an objection by the appellant's counsel at that point on foundation or something. It was overruled. And Bus said, yes, I would. This is how much money it costs. But Bus's answer was the total amount of damages. He didn't testify to each line item, but the items were there and it was available to the court. The court didn't need to have that second proceeding to issue its order. If, for whatever reason, I can't explain why the court thought it needed to have oral testimony about all 70. I'm not exactly sure of the number, but every line item, it was in the record. It was evidence before the court and available.
Your time is almost up. I do have a question for you on the prejudgment interest.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we have some case law that says that when there's a request before the court, it doesn't explicitly rule on it. We assume that there was an implicit rejection. So why shouldn't we in this situation presume that there was an implicit rejection by the district court of the request for pre-judgment interest here?
Because the district court didn't address it at all. I don't think that the district court remembered about it. If you look at the record in this case, over a year and a half between the date of the trial and the date of the final judgment. In fact, the final judge, we didn't even get an opportunity to move for costs and prejudgment interest because for whatever reason, the final judgment wasn't entered into the record until August 15th of 2022. That's when we received notice of the final judgment and appellants filed their notice of appeal 7 days later. So we didn't even have an opportunity to address that in the district court because inexplicably, no judgment was issued. Just like inexplicably, it was 9 months from the date that the matter went under advisement till the court issued those findings requesting we come back and take additional testimony. So I think it's an oversight and not an implicit denial.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
And just one more thing to that answer. The court somewhat addressed it, but didn't in its explanation of the timing. So I think that we didn't get an opportunity to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And now we will turn back to counsel for appellant for that final word. We'll have 5 minutes on the clock. And once the clock is set, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just starting with the slander of title, respondents really grasp at the contested elements here. Most fundamentally, we think respondents can't even establish that, even to the extent that the lien based on the pre-lien notice was a false statement, they can't establish that even by a preponderance, much less to the clear error standard, that the appellant knew that it was a false statement. You know, these are spelling errors, and this is, as I discussed earlier, not a model of clarity as far as what the strict compliance standard really requires. And, you know, that is the first place that the respondents cannot get even to a preponderance, much less a clear error standard on. But, you know, a lot of what respondents point out is, again, just the background facts of the case. You know, Mr. Allen had a lot of experience. That doesn't make him a lawyer. I mean, the district court, as we pointed out, found that the spelling errors didn't invalidate the pre-lien notice. And it's, we think, pretty unreasonable for someone to come in and say, the district court made this conclusion of law. Maybe it's erroneous, but to then say, well, a contractor should have known about it. That's that doesn't get them there. And malice kind of keeps falling by the wayside as you go through the other facts that appellants raise. On the new trial issue, our belief is that we shouldn't be drawing fundamental differences between court trials and jury trials to the extent that we don't have to. A court has to prove every element of the claim, and it has to do it at trial. It can't come back later and say, well, we figured out how to fix a problem, a flaw in the evidence.
I actually wanted to ask you about that, because that struck me as one distinguishing problem for you with Ginsburg, because as I read Ginsburg, it was the trial judge being dissatisfied with the jury's verdict versus this situation where the trial judge was the fact finder in the first instance and had questions at the end of the proceeding. So why isn't that a distinction that should give us pause in applying Ginsburg here in the way you would like us to?
I think the idea behind Ginsburg, and I think this is reasonably well explained in the opinion itself, is to prevent the district court from having too much discretion. And, you know, we had a paragraph at the end of our principal brief saying this is going to be a standard part of trial practice if it's something that's allowable, whether it's, you know, and in many ways it's this process that the district court chose is sort of better built for court trials than jury trials, in that, well, we didn't quite hit the nail on the head, but we should get a second shot at it, Your Honor. It's the interest of justice. I don't know, whatever reason it is. And, you know, that's, the district court already has a great deal of discretion. Its factual findings are going to be reviewed for clear error. And to add another layer on top of that, of saying, well, the district court can rehold proceedings as many times it wants until it gets the evidence that it has told the parties that it needs.
What about, though, the district court's finding that defendants are entitled to an award of damages for the cost of repairs needed to complete the home construction in a professional and workmanlike manner and in compliance with applicable Minnesota state building codes? And then the court says the evidence in the record, however, is insufficient. And then the court orders further proceedings. So isn't the court basically, you know, exercising how the evidence comes in, its discretion to manage the case and basically proceeding under Rule 611 and 614 there, in terms of clarifying the record, which it potentially has the discretion to do?
Again, our theory is, in at least in part, that you know, this sort of substantial break in the proceedings, I can't remember if it was 90 days, but it was in that neighborhood, means that the court can't come back and say, well, we're going back to the well here, so to speak.
So you're saying if the court had, rather than issued this order, had simply, you know, after both parties rested, asked for a witness to be called back, could the court have done that?
Yes, I think that's probably an acceptable procedure. You know,
and then the court asks some clarifying questions about the exhibit.
Yeah,
99.
Yeah, and if I know I'm at my time, but if I can sort of respond to that with a slightly tangential point, you know, this is 110, I think Adobe was telling me, transcript pages at the second proceeding. So this wasn't a couple of clarifying questions. This was a substantial, you know, this was a substantial proceeding. And so I think it's important to keep in mind here that we're not talking about, you know, how do these match up? You know, there's a system, I just can't quite tell what it is, versus a new universe of evidence.
I guess what I'm wondering, though, is it really a new universe of evidence where you had Exhibit 99, you had the witness, the new exhibit was just updated for inflation? You know, I mean, this is different than a brand new trial. I think you might agree with that.
Right. I mean, it's not a new trial from, you know, from step one. But if the court can't understand it and lets it go, you know, to judgment, again, the judgment that was ultimately vacated, but judgment nonetheless, and it doesn't understand it, that's part of the burden here, is to make sure that a district court can understand the damages that are being asserted. And that's a Ginsburg sidestep, I think, if this court holds otherwise, because, well, there was this part I didn't understand, so I guess we need more. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for the parties, for the excellent briefing, and for the argument here today. We will take it all under advisement. The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.